Nashville country music scene in half an hour, and he's a song of his own to play them. Brave man. Find out how he gets on in Three Chords and the Truth at 10:30. First, it's time for this week's Excess Baggage with John McCarthy.
Good morning. I'm standing in for Sandy today while she explores the wonders that Cape Town has to offer. Later in the programme, I'll be taking a look at a magazine which has long since vanished from the newsagent's shelves. The Wide World was a kind of boy's own travel adventurer's journal, published at a time when exploration was nothing other than a gentlemanly pursuit. Leafing through the journal's pages, one finds articles debating key issues like, is going over Niagara Falls in a rubber ball a good idea? And will a walk from Bradford to London train you sufficiently for a solo ascent of Everest? For answers to these and other similarly challenging questions, keep listening. First, to an area of the world which has had a profound effect on me, both in the imagination and in reality. Patagonia represented the ultimate place of escape for Brian Keenan and me when we were held hostage together in Lebanon in the late 80s. From tiny cells, we dreamed of going there, a place we read so open that you could see the planet curve. Years later, we went there for real. Arriving in Chilean Patagonia, I remember being awed by the bleak, vast landscape as we headed across it in a jeep. Suddenly, a rainbow appeared, forming a perfect arch across the entire plain, creating a fantastic gateway into a land of wonder and mystery. Joining me to talk about this remarkable place is Christabel Dilks, who fell in love with Patagonia and its people and has travelled extensively through its great tracts of wilderness, penning footprint guides along the way. Christabel, it is a vast place. It covers, it's included in two countries, Argentina and Chile. Can you give us an overview of the many and varied parts of Patagonia?
Yeah, there are four main areas that the visitor's likely to get to. Firstly, and most excitingly in a way, is the Lake District, and you needn't think of anything like Windermere. I mean, these are massive, jagged, snow-capped peaks which descend into lakes of all colours along, you know, mountains clad with dense green forest. They're exquisitely beautiful. And then that's on sort of the left-hand side along the Andes. And then further south, at the bottom of the Argentine and the Chilean side, you have an area of glaciers which are stunning, immense. And at the very bottom, you've got Tierra del Fuego, which is in fact an island, which is half Chilean, half Argentina. And then on the Atlantic coast, you have an amazing array of marine life at an area called Peninsula Valdez, which is a splay of land sticking out into the Atlantic. So those are the four main areas that the visitor's likely to get to.
I mean, it is a remarkably varied terrain. Mm. One does think of that bit that I was mentioning about the planet curving, and you can see that, but there are all these other aspects. And joining us also this morning is Ollie Campbell, who's had a chance to explore some of Patagonia. With his brother and a friend, Ollie went on a particularly unique trip to Patagonia, inspired by the writings of your great-grandfather, William Campbell. What was your grandfather doing? He was a writer.
He was a writer, amongst other things, and the thing that inspired us was the book he wrote, which was based in early footprint guide, possibly the first footprint-style guide, Victorian Lonely Planet. And he basically wrote it as an encouragement to people to actually go out there and see the place. He went out there for 3 years, travelled around, guiding people mainly, and he thought there'd been enough histories written about Patagonia, even then. Musters had written one, Darwin had been out there and done a sort of natural history. And he thought, well, how about actually encouraging people to see the place for themselves? And it's quite an inspirational book.
You were inspired also to sort of not just follow in his footsteps, but actually to go in the style that he did. Can you tell us a bit about that? Was it involved what you were wearing and how?
Yeah, we thought it was the kind of place that wouldn't have changed so much in 100 years. And so it was the kind of place, pretty rare probably on the earth now, where you could actually go back and do it in that style. And so we did it without Gore-Tex, without GPS, without radios, without tents, without sleeping bags, without anything modern, everything, as much as we could do from 100 years ago of that kind of style. So when we were in town, we were in three-piece tweed suits. And when we were on horseback, we were in bombaches and ponchos, which, to be honest, haven't actually changed that much. I mean, the riding style of 100 years ago is pretty much as it is now.
So, and did you get the stuff when you got there, or did you sort of set out from England
no,
sort of fully kitted out?
We pretty much equipped when we were out there. There's a shopping list literally in the book that describes what you have to take, including, in fact, the number of pairs of socks to take.
It's very, very important.
Very important. we just followed that list, and most things were out there.
And did it suffice? I mean, did you think, oh my God, I wish, if only we had the GPS, if only we had the Gore-Tex.
The thing that I really missed actually was the sleeping bag, but mainly because we took an appalling what seemed like a very nice poncho. Very heavy, very big, but actually not windproof. And we realised that too late. And there are ponchos, Chileno ponchos, which are much thicker. They've got the oil in them. And I think those are possibly the ones that you may have experienced. Yes, but the ones we had were useless. Looked great, did nothing. So you'd wrap up at night and the wind would go straight through and, oh.
It is a very harsh place and yet obviously completely fascinating. Your grandfather, I think you said, spent 3 years there. I mean, you were there for a shorter period. How much of his route, travellers, could you follow?
Oh, just one tiny bit, really. Mm. I mean, he did the whole of Patagonia, and he even found time to go up further north and explore a river, and also cover the Uruguayan Civil War from the Standard of Buenos Aires. Really? And he found the war frustratingly brief.
I remember reading a lot about Bernardo O'Higgins in the Chilean side, the great liberator, the man of Irish father and Chilean mother. And as we were riding across parts of Chile, particularly in Patagonia, you were conscious of the fact that this landscape had been traversed by earlier generations, and they'd gone into the wilderness to escape often from their pursuers, whoever they might be, you know, the Spanish colonial powers. And you got a real feeling of this, of a timeless landscape. You spent obviously all the time on horseback. How did you find that?
Yeah, I mean, that is spot on. I mean, partly because it's the kind of place that's only been settled, Patagonia, really for sort of just over 100 years, 150 years maybe, and the people living there are still often directly descended. And that's a really rare thing. I mean, if you meet people in everyday life, generally, you know, parents could have come from anywhere. They've lived in places all around the world, certainly all around the country. They work in one place. People move around so much. And in Patagonia, where we were, certainly in the Welsh bit, we were staying at houses built by their great-grandfather, who probably met our great-grandfather. They were still there. I mean, it is timeless. I mean, it's just incredible. It's like stepping back in time.
I spent a lot of time on the horseback thinking, this is great, but it's agony. How did you find the riding?
I like the idea of putting a big sheepskin on top of the saddle. That's definitely a good idea. We were not a good enough judge of horse flesh. I don't really ride anywhere else. And they seemed fine to us. They looked okay. They kind of moved okay. We went for one little test run. But it turned out that they were used to maybe 3 days maximum in the sort of foothills of the Andes, where it's a bit cooler and it's a bit easier. And, you know, 10 days into it, after 10 days basically of sort of baking hot plains in the Chubut Valley, they just gave up, and we had sort of bleeding noses, and they started slow and they got slower, and by the end we were going like maybe just over 1 mile an hour. I mean, we're on a horse.
So this was down to, obviously, still. You weren't experienced horsemen, so you couldn't really judge that. What happened when you lost your guide? He took his horses off with him, did he?
So he took his horses off with him, and we got a new guide with faster horses. Oh, the bliss. So we could go sort of, we started at 8 kilometres an hour, and previously we'd been going maybe 4. I mean, that's with filming. We took time to film as well, but we just sped up, and then that just released us. It meant we could go hunting more easily. It meant we could take longer siestas, you know, we could get somewhere really, important things. We could take time to pack up. It really made quite a difference. That was really helpful.
I mean, apart from feeling sore, probably because of my own experience, I remember when I was first introduced to my horse, thinking, is this going to be a very good idea? Because, you know, saying, John, here's your horse. And I was looking at him and thinking, like, get on the left hand, you know, whatever, just feeling an experience. And then I said, so what's he called? Hoping it would be, you know, Sammy or whatever, and they said, he's Charlatan. I thought, does that sound like the sort of person you can trust going up and down hills and across plains? Christabel, horse riding seems to be part of the Patagonian experience.
Absolutely. I had a couple of really interesting experiences. First of all, I had the interesting experience of going out with Patagonia's only vegetarian cattle farmer, which was, I think so. He kept bees and did yoga every so often on his patch, which is extraordinary. He put me on killer horse one day as we thundered over his lands. I thought it was rather romantic, you know, sort of thunder over, show me your lands, I thought would be nice. After that experience, I was a little bit more cautious. And when I went to stay on an estancia in Patagonia, of which there are many, and I'd thoroughly recommend that as a way of getting to know the local people. I mean, it's like staying in the guest of, you know, Lord and Lady so-and-so. They have these marvellous houses, but they're not at all stuffy. And, you know, you can ride the plains all day, which was wonderful. And so my friend, Larry, said, oh, would you like to go cattle mustering? Oh, I don't think so. I said, I've really no idea about cattle mustering. No, she said, it's quite easy. Sat me on a horse, and like you, I got on this horse and said, well, it seems like a perfectly placid beast with some trepidation. No hats, of course. This is sort of the style. They was given a poncho, so I'd look reasonably the part. And I said, what is this horse called? Hammer. she says. I was a little bit concerned. Off we went, thundering across the plains. And as you say, it was just wonderful to see that massive sky, enormous expanse of nothing, just trees and the odd wind pump rotating in the distance. And our job was to get this bunch of cattle across a couple of fields into that field, past this bunch of cattle. It was only when we were actually level with the other bunch of cattle that we realised that these were females and that the cattle we were mustering, if that's the word, were very keen on making friends with them. So that turned out to be a little bit more challenging than I'd realised.
What's it like? How did you find it looking at the landscape from horseback? Is that, do you get a different perspective?
Yes, I think it's pretty good. It's similar pace to bicycling if you cycle anywhere. I think it's wonderful to be in the landscape long enough to really notice the subtle changes rather than just what we're used to from cars where everything's sort of helter-skeltering past.
And I think with that, the advantage over cycling, certainly from my point of view, you know, is that you're not putting the effort in. Did you find that too, Ollie, that there was, you could see, you know, you had time to look and see things?
It's the it's the best way to travel, definitely, because you don't even have to worry. You don't have to look where you're going. So even better than a bike. You know, you can really just gaze about. And yeah, that changing, that slow changing of the landscape. Because I did the route again, or half the route in a car a couple of months ago, and it was just incredible. The speed with it changes. You suddenly come up to mountains. You suddenly arrive at places. Whereas this, they would slowly approach, and you'd have these great gorges, like something out of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, but in America, they look and very evocative places. And gradually, suddenly the rock would change, and then it'd be red. And then it would change colour, and then the valley would open out, and you could see where you were going, and that'd be your day's ride. You know, you could see as far as you could ride.
I remember at times you'd be riding on the horse, and suddenly you'd see a cloud in anything, and its shadow, and the shadow would be sort of coming across as if it was something coming to greet you, an idea. And your mind is often, I don't know, sort of being of the moment, if you like, in a kind of Buddhist way, and thinking, what is going on here? What's this all about? And I think you pick up the noises so much more because it's so much more. All there is the clacking of the hooves going over the stones, and you just pick up the smells coming on the breeze, which is wonderful.
I think what with Patagonia as well, it's not just the limitless space. Time as well is different there because of that, because of the time taken to travel and the time, everything becomes heightened. You're not, and I know as visitors, that's a wonderful thing about travel in a way, that life does become more real, more in colour. But that for me was wonderful to feel, well, if it takes me 5 days to get to that place, that's okay.
One of the things that I didn't really get much of a chance to see when I was in Patagonia was the glaciers. You mentioned them when we were talking earlier about the sort of some of the four main things to get to see. In fact, I was on one lake, Lago Grey in Chile, and there was a glacier a couple of miles away, but all we got at the end of the glacier was little chunks of iceberg, which are commonly carved off the original glacier. And they were coming past, and you think, well, actually, I could chip that up, and that will get in the gin and tonic this evening. But I didn't get the majesty of understand what the real pull of the glaciers was. Can you tell me a bit about that? You obviously explored
I think it's one of the most unforgettable things about all my travel in Argentina, really, because it's just, even though you're getting accustomed now to expanses of nothingness, a glacier is such an ancient thing, and there are marvellous trips that you can go on to get right up close to them, boat trips where you'll see them towering above you, these beautiful faceted turquoise blue, all sorts of shades of ice towering above you. And then you can even go for a walk on a glacier, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. I think I'd imagine it might be some sort of white ice rinky expanse, but no. What marvellously corrugated and coruscated with big ravines that you can gaze down into, and they make it perfectly safe. You put crampons on your boots and then you sort of stagger off. That was really wonderful. But another trip I made was really quite the best ever, I think. It was to see Uppsala Glacier, but from above. And we went on a very long boat trip through a series of amazing lakes with icebergs dotted about. And I had the great good fortune to be on a day on a cloudless sky, so the lakes were just sort of limpid and deep, intense blue. We arrived at this estancia, which had been apparently built by British people in 1906, so was very much like you say, Olive, that sort of the land hadn't changed at all. We were taken off in these sort of very bouncy vehicles up to an extraordinary place where there were sheer long rocks, orange terracotta coloured, that had been wiped smooth by glaciers, and where the glacier dragged up a stone that had been scored in the rock. It was an amazing experience, as soft as your cheek to touch, really beautiful. And then we stood on this amazing viewpoint and looked down onto the Uppsala Glacier, stretching out limitlessly into the horizon. I've never seen anything so immense. An experience marred only slightly by the fact that the Argentines just wouldn't stop talking. I think they were so awed, because it is an amazing experience, really, to find yourself in so much emptiness. And they couldn't
they
stop.
They had to talk to folks.
They had to chat and try to get coverage on their mobile phones, and then complain about that, and then have a smoke. There were the odd Europeans just sort of sitting contemplatively thinking, well, this is amazing.
I think the Chileans perhaps are more somber or more
reserved.
More reserved,
yes,
than the Argentines. Ollie, how did you get on with the locals? How did they receive you?
Generally incredibly friendly. And they wouldn't... We didn't go ahead. People had said perhaps you should go ahead in a truck and warn people that you're coming. But we thought that would kind of ruin it. Again, we loved the idea of just turning up and people seeing us for the first time. They hadn't. You know, they wouldn't say, oh, you're late or whatever. And they would just know, who are these people? And we'd explain there and then. And that was generally lovely. And we'd turn up and they would often sort of kill the fatted calf or the sheep, in fact, and have an asado, the classic Argentine thing where you basically take a lamb or a sheep and you spit roast it vertically in front of a fire. Occasionally we basically sleep in their gaucho huts, always on saddles, and then usually spend far too long in the evening because they obviously hadn't seen anyone for the last 2 months, and all they have is crackly radios for company, so they're pretty happy to see us. We did have, because we weren't asking permission to cross land, we did have one occasion where we were shot at. We presume by a farmer. We never actually found out. We never saw them. And there were a couple of shots. Basically, we were crossing this big expanse. And it happened to be the one place where there was no cover. And we were as far away from the any track as we could be, as sod's law. And so you're sort of trying to duck behind your horse. Because it's just nothing. You're like, you feel so exposed.
Quite a shield.
But I think they were just saying, get off my land, basically.
Your journey went along the river Rio Chubut, is that right? But it also took you into the Welsh sector, which many of us would have heard about, this part of Patagonia. How did you get on there? Are they still there?
The Welsh are, very much still there, all the way through, but certainly at each end, at the Andes and at the Atlantic end. In Gaiman, at the Atlantic side, there's all these tea shops. One tea shop in particular, where Lady Diana Spencer, Princess of Wales, we call her. They call her Lady D, and she went there and drank tea. We went to this tea house, and they still have a cup that she drank from,
and
which
the
is rather sweet.
On.
And the seat, she's
they're very proud of that.
So, Chris, I mean, you visited this area. Is it sort of, part of a sort of, one thinks of this as being a wilderness, and yet it's also part of a sort of elements of real tourism there, right?
Yes, there are, very, very isolated areas of tourism. I think one of the most wonderful things about it is that you're not going to a place that is touristed out kind of thing. It's not presented for the tourists. It's very authentic. And Gaiman does hold on to its Welsh heritage very fiercely. They have many, many Welsh speakers. They have Ice Deadfords every year. And a charming museum where the vegetarian cattle farming boyfriend was pursuing his Welsh lineage. And it was, I found it really moving to see these artifacts that the Welsh had brought with them in pursuit of a better land. Organs, beautifully pleated cotton shirts, delicate objects to live in a really wild and barren place. I thought that was amazing. And in fact, having learned all about the sort of the austerity that they went through and their amazing spirit of endurance, to go and sit down to a Welsh tea where no less than 14 kinds of cake are offered, it felt to me, and they're called traditional Welsh teas, this is what made me laugh. They would all say, yes, the Welsh had these sorts of teas. And he'd say, maybe not quite. I think the ancestors would have had a fit if they'd seen these lemon pie and carrot cake, chocolate cake with a leche.
Which weren't for it. And over in Chile, I don't think the Welsh got over the Andes or across the plains there. There seemed to be more, to be settled more by Spanish, but also by English and Scots, and subsequently Croatians, or Yugoslavs, as they would have been when they went there, which is very interesting. I remember coming across the strange mishmash of names, which kind of summed all this up. There's one guy, I've made a note of it, he was some local official, but his name was in some restaurant where we were standing, giving some local law. But it was Carlos McKenney Schmauk. So I think they're all there, all these people. And it's drawn people from all over the world. And it still is. Obviously, we've been talking about tourism a bit and travelling there as visitors. But there's a big issue now about, what they're going to do with all that land, with the forests, with the beautiful forests there.
Oh, they're amazing forests. Yeah.
And I remember one of the abiding memories of heading to Patagonia was leaving a city called Puerto Montt, and there were these mountains of wood chips, which is just virgin forest that had been chipped, and it was going to be exported, I think, to Japan for the paper industry. Obviously you've travelled over both, but what is the sort of environmental issues? What are the Argentines or Chileans thinking about this?
Well, they're waking up pretty late to the fact that you have to be ecologically very, very aware. I mean, in Argentina, fortunately, deforestation has been nothing like so severe. I noticed that particularly when I crossed the border from the Argentine Lake District into the Chilean, that it was, gosh, suddenly there were no trees. So on the Argentine side, they know that Valdivian rainforest, they've got virgin forest. It's not secondary forest, it's the original stuff, hosting a whole variety of wildlife and ecosystems that they must remain in place. And so they've converted lots of the areas to national parks, which are beautifully run, with really helpful, friendly park rangers, good maps, limited areas for walking. And in fact, one of my most amazing experiences was in a park called Los Alerces, where I was taken on a... I'm very anti going on guided tours and trips, but I went
even,
on a boat
even
trip.
As a guide writer yourself.
You have to, of course, yes, in order to be able to write about them. But this was a really beautiful trip, because the chap said early on, it would be great if we didn't talk as we go around the woodland. And having had my glacier experience, I realised why, that the Argentines, you know, they're very sociable. So we wandered around, and it was true, you could smell the difference between the area of beech forest and then Arashan forest, which are these amazing barley sugar covered coloured trees with flaking, soft cinnamon coloured bark. Amazing, beautiful trees. The tall beech forest. And then we got to these Alerce trees, which are 2,400 years old. All intact, all with beautiful wildlife all around them, birdsong. So I think the Argentines are realising that they have to, that's a great asset for them. And I think they're going to limit now the extent to which foreigners can buy up huge tracts of land.
That's great. Well, my thanks for the moment to Cristobal Dilks and Oliver Campbell. Have you spent time in Patagonia, perhaps sleeping under the stars like Ollie and his brother? If so, we'd love to hear your stories, so email them to us at bbc.co.uk/radio4/excess baggage. Patagonia is far from being the only taste of wilderness you may have heard on Excess Baggage. Way back in May last year, Sandy devoted a whole programme to the subject of solitary wilderness journeys when she spoke to Paul Watkins about his travels in the depths of Norway. Well, these things plant the germ of an idea in some of your minds, and Alice the Troop has got in touch to say that the item has inspired him. And on February the 7th, he embarks with skis, tent, food and fuel across southern Norway, traversing forests, fjords, mountains and the Hardangervidda Plateau. I hope I said that right. Thank you, Alistair, for letting us know, and have a great trip and keep safe. The aspiring traveller of 100 years ago had fewer outlets for their passion than the armchair adventurer of today. But they did have something which we don't. The Wide World, True Adventures for Men. This magazine was published from the late 19th century until the swinging 60s and was packed with amazing, often unbelievable but nevertheless true, tales of survival, catastrophe and general daring do, gathered from across the globe. With me I have Paul Safont, a writer and editor, who has put together an anthology of some of the best stories. Paul, how and where did you discover Wide World?
Well, it's funny, just going back to Ola's modest story about his grandfather. My grandfather used to read this. I used to go and stay with him, read these magazines and not be able to sleep at night because I'd be so terrified about coming across black mambas or king cobras. And some were left and they sat in a box in the loft, and one day I was sorting things out and I came across them. I was just blown away still at the sort of vivid sort of excitement of these stories. I bought a few and then I got the idea of putting a collection together. It ran for such a long time, nearly 70 years, so there was just a huge wealth of material to choose from.
I mean, it's interesting you're picking up on that idea of being inspired by earlier generations, what your grandfather read and what Ollie's great-grandfather had done. And undoubtedly there are some great stories in the anthology, but amazing ones, not necessarily encouraging all of them. Just flicking through it, one that caught my eye was this story of Over Niagara Falls in a Rubber Ball.
Yes, please don't do this at home. It's an incredible story of a man called Jean Lussier, who's a worker in an inner tube factory and then has this dream that people are going over Niagara Falls in barrels traditionally and always come out sort of minced, basically, as potted meat or something. And so he thinks, well, a rubber ball is the solution. So he builds this huge rubber ball in which he suspends himself and then sends himself over the falls. He sort of comes out of his sort of harness halfway through, bounces around a bit, but he does survive.
And so who do you think, I mean, what Wide World was writing, well, who was their audience? Who were the stories aimed at?
I think it was the sort of armchair, sort of suburban, sort of armchair travellers, would-be travellers. Obviously, we live in this great age of jet travel. I presume Ollie didn't ride to Patagonia. No. He took a plane there. You know, you're obviously your grandfather probably took a steamer. Yes, and so that kind of travel was really not available. I mean, most people speaking to people about this magazine, people say that it did reading it satisfied their wanderlust. But it was very much aimed for men. It was for men who wore shorts in winter, men who would never ever take a puncture to a bicycle repair shop. They do it themselves. That sort of suburban real men, in other words. Yes.
Many of the tales are fascinating reading, but they're also seriously cautionary tales, quite alarming.
So very scary.
There's the one I read it last night, rather too late actually, had me up most of the night. Was the story of a man in Africa in the late 1890s.
That's right.
Who was attacked by a lion.
That's right, carried out by a lion. Yeah, the vivid thing is about reading in bed is that he was in bed when it happened. You know, it's the worst thing. You know, putting the book down, switching the light out. He was working on the Cape to Cairo Telegraph. He was a telegraphist. He wasn't an explorer. A lot of the people in these things happen to aren't explorers. They're not asking for this kind of excitement. It happens to them. And basically, he goes to bed after a long day's work. He closes his mosquito net, which he describes rather ominously like a great meat cage around him. And a lion breaks into his hut, carries him off. And the writing is extremely vivid, excruciating. He's got some distance from it as he's carried off the lion, changing its bite on him to suck at his flesh and trying to get him over his shoulder, the lion sort of flinging around. Fortunately, it's pitch black at this moment in the jungle. Fortunately, a friend of his managed to find him underneath this baobab tree with a lion, and manages he takes one shot, hits the lion, then the gun jams. He hits the lion with a gun, gets another gun, and manages to shoot the lion.
Reading of another story which couldn't be reported by the man himself, ultimately, because he died, but it was a real serious but eccentric adventure. Was this was of Morris Wilson?
Morris Wilson, yes. I mean, of all the stories in this, I mean, like most people, you've read quite a lot of travel stories and things like that. It really is, for me, one of the most amazing true stories I've ever heard. It's basically about a man called Morris Wilson, who is decorated in the First World War. He's shot up. He's got a useless right arm. He's inspired religiously. A lot of these travellers inspired for proper, you know, geographical exploration reasons. He's inspired religiously. He discovers for him prayer and fasting, which seems to alleviate all his pains. And he conceives of this plan to demonstrate this to the world by scaling Everest on his own. This is in 1933-34. To get there, he does something amazing in the first place. He flies to India single-handedly in a plane that you buy second-hand.
And he's learned to fly to do that.
He had to learn to fly. He was a terrible pilot. He sets off on this huge trip with a trailing wind, you know, the first thing you shouldn't do. But he manages to get there by just great, astonishing, steely determination. The authorities trying to stop him at all moments. He gets there, you know, he's always with barely enough fuel. He gets there. The plan was to crash land into base camp. This was his way of not having to do the long march. But he gets there. He has to travel across Indian Nepal disguised as a monk. And he doesn't make it. He gets up just above base camp 3. He's beaten back, but he goes back again. He's kind of flinging himself at this mountain, and he dies. And obviously we've heard about, you know, we tend to hear about sort of Tenzing and Hillary or Mallory and Irving, because we, you know, speculation they might have got there. He didn't get there. He got to 22,000 feet, but it is an amazing story.
My thanks to Paul Safont, and also many thanks to my other guests, Oliver Campbell and Christabel Dilks. Next week, Sandy is back to tell us where the Romans and the Vikings went for their summer holidays. Until then, from all of us at Excess Baggage, farewell.
The website for Excess Baggage can be found at bbc.co.uk/radio4. The presenter was John McCarthy, and the producer was Kevin Dawson.
Sunshine. Sending a story home. It just lets him know that I am still thinking about him. Try for me. And I do still love him.
We're going to make this story for our children to understand why their mums have been naughty.
BBC Radio 4 hears from prisoners who are recording stories for their children.
For to hear my voice and tell a story, and that when I couldn't be there, when she needed her parents most of all, it really helped.
The Goodnight Tapes, on Monday morning at 11.
Now on BBC Radio 4, Nick Barraclough goes behind the scenes on Music Row in the last of his series Three Chords and the Truth to find out whether country music's great maxim can stand its ground in Nashville today.
This is a little song I wrote long ago. We have a message for George Bush, and it's a really simple one. You're fired.
It's a few weeks to polling day in the 2004 presidential elections, and in a brightly lit bar at the top of Music Row, the centre of Nashville's music industry, a crowd has gathered to hear country divas Becca Bramlett and Nancy Griffith. But this isn't the usual honky-tonk crowd. They're calling it a karaoke, and these people are singing their hearts out as members of a newly formed organisation, the Music Row Democrats.